Well, the world is dumpster fire, and nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good, and you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And today on the show, we have got Harry Sherwood. This is a fantastic conversation, and I'm going to let us get into it quickly. But first, grab yourself a piece of cake, put on a paper hat, and let's say happy birthday to me. I normally don't advocate for getting attention just for the mere fact that I exist. But I've been thinking about that kind of a lot today. I received a message from my mother wishing me a happy birthday. My family's been asking me, what do you want to do for your birthday? And every year I get depressed around my birthday. And you know what's weird about that? What's weird about that is that I get depressed because I think back on where I was at the year before versus where I'm at now. And every year, for at least over a decade now, I have been in a position that has been better than the year before it, and yet I end up feeling like a failure who has accomplished nothing. And that is how I still feel, which is crazy because I am alive after, not to bring things down, but after so many suicide attempts, after near misses with severe drug addiction, severe alcohol dependency, just car crashes of life decisions, I'm alive and I'm here for another one, doing better than I've ever done in my life. And yet, there are things that I still want to accomplish, things that I still want to do. And the fact that I haven't already done them, the fact that I haven't already accomplished everything, I beat myself up over that. I don't know. It's a really strange phenomenon. Can you relate to this? Am I alone in this? Because I don't think I am. I don't think I am. This marks 44 years on this planet for me. And I didn't think I was going to live past 15. I really didn't. I mean, if things had gone another way, I would have died at 9. And that's just something to really think about. So you know what? I'm going to be instead grateful. I'm going to make note of the things that I would like to work on and like to change, and I'm going to work on them. But I'm also going to recognize that I'm in a place that's a good place, and it took a lot of hard work to get here, so I should celebrate that. I should celebrate that. If I can't celebrate anything else, I should celebrate the fact that I've worked hard to be a decent human being and that there's still more that I can and should and will do because I'm alive. Whatever it is you think your legacy is in life, no matter how old you are, if you've still got breath, you've still got a chance. So let's do this together. Let's get out there and let's try some stuff. Let's not be afraid to fall down or fail or make mistakes. Let's get out there and try some stuff and see if we can make ourselves better today than we were yesterday. Let's try that. And if you're looking for a place to start, look no further than consciously.org. It's a website dedicated to holistic living, that's whole with a W, and there is now actually an online meditation group that meets every single day at 7 a.m. Pacific. You can get in on that and get a little bit of relaxation and peace. You know, clear your mind of the clutter so that you can get to work. You let me know how it's going for you, and I'll let you know how it's going for me. But right now, let's talk to Harry Sherwood. Well then, let's just start here. Hi, how you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's kind of an unusual thing for me lately to be doing great, but I'll take it. I found out how important sleep can be. Imagine that. Right. I've never been a person who really understood that, and I don't know why, because every time I get a good night's sleep, I feel great. But tell me a little bit about you. First of all, where do you come from?
Right now, I'm in Los Angeles, California.
Where'd you grow up?
Born in Michigan.
Michigan.
Born in our... but I've lived in L.A. for most of my life. I've left a few times, but I've always come back. So the weather's amazing. Certain parts are beautiful, so I enjoy it.
I'm also born in Michigan, now living in California.
Hey, there you go.
I get it. There's no snow. Unless you want it.
Right.
Which is kind of great. But tell me a little bit about your background, because I know that you have developed this affinity for meditation and Tai Chi. And I want to know how a person gets there.
So I guess to make a very long story, not quite so long. When I was in my teens, I just felt suffocated by life. I felt very uncomfortable in my own skin, insecure, mm-hmm. a lot of fears. But I also externally had a very good life. I was a partier, jock, football player, chased women. It was fun.
Yeah.
But inside, it felt like the walls were closing in a bit. And we can get into why that was the way it was, so on and so forth. But that kind of led me to want to go on a quest, honestly, go on some sort of spiritual adventure. I'd seen it in so many cartoons growing up and movies and literature. And I said, why not? You know, that sounds fun. So it did. It led me to China, and I studied Tai Chi and Qigong in China with the Shaolin monks for 4 months. It led me to an ashram in the States and lived with monks and yogis for 6 months. And that year sparked, and I was around age 19, that sparked this this adventurous spirit, or it brought it out within me. And then that led to a degree in religious studies. It led me to Ghana, to Indonesia, to Thailand, led me back to the ashram a second time in the States, lived there for another 5 months. Since then, I met my partner in life, partner in business. She's wonderful. She had a very traumatic background. So, she taught me a lot in certain spaces, and we kind of came together, and we have a deep bond, and then continuously leading me to alternate experiences, meditation being one of them, plant medicines, things like psilocybin and ayahuasca, sitting with indigenous medicines, doing some sweat lodges with Native Americans, song circles, so on and so forth. So it's been a very adventurous last decade.
I bet. I mean, that is a lot. There's definitely a lot to unpack there, but take me back to that kind of inciting incident. or situation, let's say, because it's never just one incident with anybody. You tend to find out that it's actually usually a series of things that leads you to decide, I'm going to make some changes. Where did that start for you?
So for me, it's kind of somewhat, you know, I don't want to say it's a common narrative, but it's not uncommon. Being, you know, growing up in the States in the era that I did, it's kind of a part of the lost generation. Mm-hmm. And meaning that there, my dad really wasn't home. And when he was, he really wasn't there.
Yeah.
And my mom loved me, but didn't know how to set a boundary to save her life. So I had no guidance. I felt like I was floundering in my basically 5 through 18. And so I latched onto my friends, but like I said, that just led to parties and fights and a lot of insecurity. And I think the most suffocating part about all of it was I couldn't have told you any of this at that age.
Yeah.
I was just trying to find my way, and I had a lot of fear and a lot of cockiness, and you mix those two together and it doesn't necessarily, create the best, the funnest person to be around. And so just over time, waking up hungover, waking up just like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
Like really, what am I doing with my time? And you know, my oldest brother is an addict, and he has been since I was 10.
Yeah.
My middle brother at that time, was heading down a very similar route. Fortunately, he didn't go down that quite as much, but, so all the men in my life were not people to look up to. And it just wore on me, over time. And, fortunately I did have this adventurous spirit inside. And like you said, it was just years of compounded floundering.
Yeah.
But there were a few things that really pushed me to jump off into the deep end, going to China.
Well,
one of them, I was graduating high school, and I was planning to go to the University of Arizona and party for another 4 years.
Right. And it's a good place to do it.
It's on one of the top lists of party schools. And I got really high, and I curled up in my bed for 5 hours, and I just contemplated my life. And by the end of those 5 hours, I came out and I said, I'm not going to Arizona. I'm going to go to community college around here. I'm going to get a job, and I need to figure out some shit.
Yeah.
It was really pivotal. It was really pivotal because it helped me become who I am. So there was this stark look in the what the hell am I doing
mirror
at 18. And then there's a couple others after that. I kept drinking and partying. And one day I went to – so Self-Realization Fellowship was founded by a yogi from India. And that's the ashram that I went to live at. But before then, I went to some of their Sunday services and learned about their meditation techniques. And one time I went and I was so hungover that I was still drunk. And I was sitting in the audience, and the monk who was speaking, honestly, I don't even know if I recall what he said. I think all I remember was he said, your life can go two different ways. Whichever way it goes is up to you. And he pointed directly at me out of 500 people.
Yeah.
Pointed directly at me. And I'm just, you know, like sweating alcohol at this point. And that really impacted me too. And so there was a couple moments of, hey man, you have a choice to make and it's yours to make.
Yeah.
And yeah. I wound up choosing away.
You know, it's funny that you bring that up because you reminded me of an instance that I had in my past where I was struggling with some different things. I really had no idea what I was going to do or how I was going to live. I had no plan for anything beyond the next day or two, ever, at any given point. Because I just had this thing in my head that I probably wasn't going to survive it anyway. And so whatever I was doing just had to get me through the day. And that was my way of putting off being suicidal was I'll get through today and I'll not think about a future, because the future is scary. The future requires change. It requires action. And I remember, and this is a memory that just came to me. I remember, that I was with some friends and we were buying drugs off of this guy. And I remember looking through his CD collection and he had a CD, of a band I liked that I hadn't heard before. And he told me I could have it because he wasn't listening to it. And there was a song on the CD about, not doing drugs and just because they slow you down. They make you less good at your job. Like if you're a musician. And I was a drummer, and I had these weird rules about things. Like, well, I'm not going to get messed up if I have to play drums because it's going to slow me down. But it was the first time it had ever occurred to me that it could be slowing me down everywhere else in life. And I pretty much just stopped. And I remember the first time I told my friends that I didn't want to get high because I just wasn't interested. They looked at me like I had three heads. And then I got new friends because when you're not that person anymore, you kind of can't exist within that dynamic anymore. Or at least I didn't know how to. And so it's interesting that you found yourself in a situation that wasn't working, but you were sort of in the middle of it being, you know, fucked up in a situation where you were seeking some kind of enlightenment, but you showed up still drunk. And that's kind of a great metaphor in a lot of ways, because you were not there yet. You were on your way to something, even if you weren't entirely sure what it was. That's kind of interesting to me.
And it's very metaphorical for what's happened over the last decade since then, because I tell my story a lot and people hear, like, I kind of laid it out very briefly, like, wow, you've done a lot of things. It's pretty cool. It's amazing. But there was a lot of shit in between, and there's a lot of reasons why I kept seeking.
Yeah.
Because I had this deep unrest in my soul, this deep resistance to life. I mean, a deep one.
Yeah.
So I was at a training. It was called Master in Transformational Training, 6 years ago. And at this point I had done a lot of what I talked about, you know, years of meditation, living with monks, all that had already happened. And I went to this training, and one of the exercises they had us do was you had to sit directly in front of someone else. And for 2 minutes, they just asked you, what do you want? And the second you answer, they'd ask it again. And then you answer and they ask it again. And the whole point was to get you to get out of your head and to see what your heart actually had to say. And so I was the asker first. And by the time I was done, she was bawling. My partner was bawling. And then I was like, shit, like, I don't know what I'm about to say.
Yeah.
Three or four canned responses. But then she's like, what do you, and the other part was they tell you, like, get more intense every time. So by the time you're on your sixth question, you're like, what do you want? And they're like, what
do you want? I want this to stop.
And so she asked me a few, and I had my canned responses, enlightenment, blah, blah, blah. But then it got to the point where I didn't, like, it just, I went blank. And all that came out was, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be here anymore. And I couldn't say anything else for the rest of the 2 minutes. And I started just bawling so much that she started crying. The guy who was running my group came by, saw it. He started crying. Like, it was full breakdown. And all I could say was, I don't want to be here. And there was this deep resistance to being alive, this deep resistance to being human.
Yeah.
I mean, it was essentially just the experience of being human up till that point in my life, I hadn't fully accepted. I rejected it. I rejected suffering. I rejected how shitty sometimes it was. And it was, to this day, it's still something that I'm sitting with and working with. I'm doing a lot of shadow work right now. And my shadow's greatest fear is letting life be as it is, whatever that means. And I fear being immensely vulnerable, because vulnerability to me is like putting a baby child in the middle of the woods.
Yeah.
It's going to die. Yeah. Like, go help the child. But can I surrender? Can I let go? And one of the greatest spiritual teaching in almost any spiritual tradition is surrender. Can you truly let go enough to let a higher power guide you?
That's a tough one.
Can you let their... Super tough. It's super tough.
But you're talking about that moment of breaking down and weeping and saying, I don't want to be here. And the person who's with you recognizing that, feeling that empathy and weeping as well. And the teacher coming over and weeping. That is an incredibly powerful show of vulnerability on all fronts. And that's one that I don't know that a lot of people would be comfortable with. It takes a little surrender to give into something like that. And surrender is something that's really quite difficult, like you're saying. But that's interesting that this was what you started to gravitate towards. What was the situation like as far as conversations about mental health or sharing your feelings or anything like that growing up? Were there any conversations around that at all? Because there should be some kind of teaching that you got from that, whether it was direct or indirect.
Yeah, to me, it wasn't actually unsafe. It wasn't unsafe. Like, I did have a space to talk about it. Whether I took that space or not was different.
Yes.
And so for me, like, my mom was a little woo-woo growing up. And so she took me to a chiropractor who did, like, things like craniosacral and certain types of emotional release things.
Yeah.
That mixed with some court ordered therapy I had to go to when I was younger because of some shit I got into. So I had a couple spaces, but nothing extensive. And the interesting part was I wasn't necessarily ever resistant to it. I just never really did it.
Yeah.
I guess.
That's so. But having a mom who's kind of into, like, you know, as you said, woo-woo kind of stuff, that probably would have the door sort of cracked open for being open to things that are maybe outside what the mainstream might call normal. Because your normal was a little different than other people's normal. And once you get to know a lot of people, you start to find out just about everybody's normal is a little bit different than each other.
Yeah.
So how do you get comfortable with meditation? Meditation is one of those things that whenever I talk to a person about meditation, I betray myself and my own fears about it, because I always ask, yeah, but how do you silence the voice that comes up to tell you you're garbage when the silence shows up?
Yeah, that's a really powerful question. So one of the biggest breakthroughs in my meditative practices came the second time when I was at the ashram. And up to that point, like, I had been meditating a lot, about 2 to 3 hours a day for years on end. And I had many beautiful experiences, truly profound peaks behind the veil, so to say. But it was still a deep battle. It wasn't fluid. It was, all right, here we go. You know, pull up your sleeves because it's meditation.
Okay.
But then my second stay, I guess there's like five different stories that I'm going to mix into one message. But pretty much one of the main, the ashram administrator, the head monk, when myself and a couple other people were talking to him, you know, he had mentioned, someone had said, you know, I'm so restless. I can't stop thinking. My mind won't shut up and it's very negative. And he said, okay, well, what part of you is aware that you have thoughts? And the guy's like, I don't know, me. He said, okay. And what part of you is you? Like, define that. And he didn't really know how to define it. And he said, well, think about it like this, that there is an awareness inside of you that is aware of thoughts. So therefore, there's a separation. There's a subject and object. The object is the thought, but there's a subject aware of those thoughts. And he said, if you can start to create some distance, you recognize you're not your thoughts. You have them. Mm-hmm. You're not your emotions. You have them. And when we can start to create a little bit of distance, even if it's microscopic at first, we start to disidentify with the mind, essentially. We have a mind. We're not the mind. And the more that I've been able to apply that and dive deeper, the more I recognize that the mind is a system of programs. Most of them external. Most of them it's cultural programming. Where was I born? When was I born? Who raised me? What were their opinions, beliefs, views? And so it created this mode of operation and this identity that I call Harry. And the more I've been able to gain a little bit of separation from that, the more I recognize, like, oh, that's actually not who I truly am. I'm this thing behind it. I'm this awareness, this deep sense of awareness, which if you start to look in different scriptures, you see stuff like the Buddha nature or the soul or the, you know, the Atman or wherever you want to go. They talk about this depth of being that's beyond mind. Or it's purified mind in the Buddhist terms. And so as I started to experience that, what wound up happening over years is I could wrestle with this mind, or I could recognize the mind's just going to be the mind, right? It's just going to function the way it functions. I can help reprogram it a little bit with some mindset work, of course. But I can also just let the mind be the mind. It's like a 4-year-old running around. Yeah. And if I recognize I'm not the mind, I just have this constant thing going on, but I stop taking it so seriously. That's been the biggest game changer for me, is like, oh, okay, there goes the mind. There goes Harry even.
Yeah. What did you learn about yourself through all of that travel? Because when you travel places, I find that if you're open to the change of culture, and I'm talking even within your own country, if you're open to experiencing whatever the new culture is, you'll definitely find something out about yourself through listening. Mm-hmm. But traveling abroad, there is still sort of, I don't know how it is for you, but I know that when I travel internationally, and it's rare, but when it's happened, it dawned on me how many preconceived notions I had about things. And that just opens a whole other can of thought. And it made me a lot more aware of my surroundings and paying attention. And it made me a lot more aware of myself and where I saw myself as part of the global environment. What about you? What was your experience with travel?
Similar. So my first big culture shock was China.
I bet.
And it, in a lot of ways, it was just, you know, no hot water for showers. It was kind of reverse. They only cold water for showers and only hot water to drink because the cold water was contaminated. Hmm. So They had to boil all the water to eat. And most of the, so it was obviously in China, but it was an international school. So actually most of the Chinese didn't speak English. Only one of them did out of all of them. So interacting with my Tai Chi trainer was all watch and repeat and just nonverbal communication. And that was fascinating. Yeah. That taught me a lot about the universal language, which is energy, body movements, and mannerisms. And that was really big. And that was huge. The poverty level that I saw and that I lived around, like they would just stack trash 10 feet high and then burn it. Like that's how they took care of their stuff.
Yeah.
But there was also a sense of, oh, they're not that different to me. There was a sense of, wow, like there's a lot of similarities being human. There's a shared experience, even though there's a lot of differences, there's a lot of similarities. And China really was far more of a cultural adventure than it was like a spiritual adventure, which is what I was looking for. But the culture really was the main impactor. And it started to invite a different way of life into my purview. At this point, I was very open for one. So I didn't walk in saying, well, this is the way it's going to be. I walked in saying, change me.
Yeah.
Because I don't like me. So I was very open to be malleable. And what I found is after that and after the ashram, especially after the ashram, the biggest culture shock I've ever had was coming back from the ashram into my old life. Because I felt like I was on a car going 60 and I just jumped off.
Yeah.
So when I landed, I crashed and tumbled for like 30 yards. And I stood up and was like, what the hell is this? I had gone into a time machine and I had had a year of intensive change, intensive practices, intensive looking within myself and saying, who is this Harry? Is there something beyond Harry? Is there something more to reality than I currently know? And really didn't just ask these. I sat in hundreds of hours of meditation trying to answer this question. And then I come back to the world and I see billboards one after the other about all this stuff that I hadn't even contemplated in a year. And it felt gross. Like I walked back in, I felt dirty being back in the world.
Yeah.
And it was really like, wow, I've been living in a very suffocating energy most of my life. No wonder I wanted to get out. And so that, you know, it really just started to open the subtleties of no matter where I've been, I've picked up things that say, oh, I really like this. How can I apply it? And then I've picked up things where I'm like, I don't like this. I'm going to leave this behind.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
I think that's the best thing that you could do when you're deciding what kind of a person you're going to be is assembling the things that are going to help you to be more of a whole human being versus the things that are going to try to fracture you into these smaller pockets of the person you need to be situationally, because I think if you really look at the way we live our lives, certainly in this country, we are sort of expected to fracture ourselves into different versions of ourselves for different situations versus being kind of a whole person who's just kind of comfortable being that one person. But being comfortable being one person is something that doesn't necessarily come easy for a lot of people.
Yeah. And that, I believe, has to do with the cultural programming, like we talked a bit about earlier. You know, we're from the moment that we're born, we have to, our early brain says survival.
Yeah.
And for almost the first 6 years of life before our neocortex is fully formed, like we don't have the analytical brain. You know, most of this is an emotional call and response. And so if I cry, I get mother's milk. If I poop and I, you know, we're learning subconsciously so much of how to fit in to survive in the current paradigm. And anything that doesn't fit that, we put off to the side. We suppress or repress at that time. We're unconscious that we're doing it. And so as we get older, we have this mask of what fits and the shadow of what doesn't fit. And it, like you said, it fractures us.
Yeah.
It splits us into two, really three, because there's also the deeper essence of self. So there's like this triple fractured self, which are all one, but we're so programmed neurologically to fit in because it's survival.
Yeah.
And it's something as simple as something I hear a lot is, well, it's very challenging for people to be wrong sometimes.
Yes.
Right. And so, I'm gonna blame other people. No, it's their fault. Even if, you know, it partially is their fault. And sometimes we get so frustrated with those types of people of like, no, it's their fault. It's never my fault. I'm the victim here. But if we look at why is that there, it's actually really biologically for survival. Because if it's my fault, then there's a higher chance that I'm going to be extricated from the tribe, which means death in ancient times. So it's literally for me to admit myself at fault and subconsciously equals death, which is why a lot of people struggle to be able to look in the mirror and say, okay, I need to get real with some shit.
Yeah.
It's more pertinent to their survival not to get real with it and to stay the course of tunnel vision, of mask. And that's something that it's been a very big, intense roller coaster of learning to take off the mask and to deconstruct and to let the shadow in and all that stuff.
Yeah, because understanding all of that isn't the same as living all of that. It takes a lot to get yourself to a place where you can kind of quickly assess your current mode and make a change. It's not something that comes easy. I was a person who was, for a very long time, very risk-averse. Just about anything. No conflict, no trouble, even when it was necessary. And then once you become kind of more comfortable with the idea of, let's say, upsetting the apple cart for the right purpose, the situation is smooth sailing if nobody rocks the boat. But if the boat is about to crash into an iceberg, it doesn't do to be proper. Sometimes you've got to shout, there's a fucking iceberg. And it helps to be able to reconcile the fact that you've got these situations where you may be wrong even, but there are worse things that you can be than wrong. So tell me a little bit about how you are now as far as daily struggles with things. When sadness or anger or anything like that comes up for you. I mean, you're a person, so these things still exist. Oh, yeah. You don't turn into a robot when you get enlightened. How do you process those things differently now versus before you started to try to make some changes?
So I have a different relationship with my emotions. You know, they're always going to be a part of the human experience, like you're saying, but it's no longer anger to me. And this is a work in progress. You know, this isn't something I've mastered by any means, but when anger comes up, can I let it be there without making it wrong, without needing it to leave? You know, this goes back to the not wanting life to be life. It's really not wanting emotions to be emotions.
Yeah.
So, okay. Anger's here. Can I be with this? Can I sit with it? Why is it here? What is it telling me? Okay, there's a trigger here, obviously, from something. Okay, she just did this. I'm pissed off. Why? So there might be some self-reflection that happens in that moment. Might need to wait a few minutes and really come down off of the super, you know, the extreme emotional reaction, if there is one. But where my work is right now is, in the past, I've seen emotions as a hierarchy. Love and connection up here, fear and hatred down here. And where my work's been is turning that sideways into a spectrum. Just like the visible light spectrum, right? There's just different colors, different frequencies of energy. Same thing with emotions. Literally, we know this. We can measure emotional frequency. And so it's just different. It's not better and worse. And so I'm trying to experience whatever comes up. And sometimes some dark shit comes up because that's a part of the human experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I ask myself, okay, just can I be here fully as much as I would be here with love, joy, peace, gratitude? Because I love being with those things, right? And the more that I do that, the less charged they are and the less knocked off course I am. And the more I recognize, wow, you know, this all falls in the experience of consciousness. There's not less consciousness in anger than there is in love. It's just a different experience. And the more that that happens, the less they control me. Because I don't fear them anymore. I don't judge them. I don't charge them. And when they're uncharged, they pass through. And, you know, like I said, this is a work in progress. Sometimes it does derail me. Sometimes I'm exhausted afterwards. You know, right now, like I said, I'm doing a lot of shadow work. And so that shadow work is, okay, what is this deep rooted fear that's inside of me that I can feel? And I don't, like 3 weeks ago, I had a traumatic emotional release where I, for 10 to 20 minutes, was shaking as I was bawling because I was sitting with this deep, deep fear and judgment of myself. But I allowed myself to be there and I processed it. I experienced it. And it was profound. I mean, it came from the same depths as some of my most beautiful spiritual experiences. Like, it came from the core of being.
Yeah.
And it was just another affirmation to, this is really, really powerful if I stop rejecting it. And I also, like I said, it goes back to control, because some people then kind of, you know, they might get a little nervous, rave a little red flag and say, well, what if you let out the beast? And it's like, well, we have to confront the beast, be with the beast, and understand the beast so the beast doesn't control us and wind up doing shit like you look out the door and we see is happening every day.
Yeah.
If we just confront it and make peace with it instead of fighting it, maybe feeding it and letting it just be, letting it express what it needs to in a safe way. And so that's really been the focus of my work for the last 6 months to a year.
Well, it sounds like you're definitely on a great path. And I thank you for sharing that with all of us today.
I appreciate that. It's been incredible and incredibly humbling. Every time I think I have it figured out, something else comes up. And so one of the things I'm sitting with now is, and yet, like, oh, this is my experience. And yet it'll probably be different tomorrow. And it's like, okay, let's just keep going. Let's see what life has to offer.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
And there you have it. Wasn't that a great conversation? I gotta say, I'm feeling a lot more uplifted lately. I'm not sure where that's coming from, this renewed sense of optimism. But if you want to get some more Harry in your life, and I know that you do, just go to consciously.org. That's where you'll find the link to the daily meditation, 7 a.m. Pacific, every single day, and all kinds of other amazing resources. And that's all I got for this week. Thanks for being here on my birthday. It really means a lot to me that you guys are here each and every week. I don't know how many of you actually listen all the way through the end of the show, but today I think I'll do something just a little bit different. I'm going to play just a little bit of bass guitar because I bought myself one for my birthday, and this is for me. Don't kill yourselves out there.